The following talk was given at the Insight Meditation Center in Redwood City, California. Please visit our website at audiodharma.org.
So I wanted to speak this morning about one of the important teachings, central teachings of Buddhism, which is the Four Noble Truths. And in doing so, I'd like to suggest that very important part of our practice of mindfulness, of insight practice, and Buddhism as a whole, is to learn to see our experience, see our life in a new way. And sometimes there's a cliche or a little saying that this practice of ours is not so much about having a new experience as it is about seeing our experience in a new way. And so if we're focusing on having a new experience, changing what's happening and having something better, sometimes we miss the opportunity to see or understand or relate to our experience in a new way. And the Four Noble Truths are offered as a way to help with the seeing. And it's to see our suffering in a new way, in a useful way. The Four Noble Truths, for those of you who don't know it, are four statements or insights that have to do with how we suffer. It says the first truth is that from time to time you will suffer, and that suffering has a cause or an origin, and there is a possibility of the cessation, coming to the end of that suffering, and there's a way to do that. So the beginning of this is to so it's really to address suffering and to become free of it. But how do we look at it in a new way? And this is one of the things that meditation helps with. One of the purposes of meditation is to become calmer, to become more confident, to become clear, have clear understanding, see more clearly what's going on, and to have compassion, the four C's. So to have calm, confidence, clarity, and compassion. And so we sit, maybe calm is the most obvious one, sit and we're agitated and busy and stressed, and people often associate meditation with becoming calm. And meditation is not meant to be an escape from our life, but rather to give us a vantage point to step right into the middle of our life in a new way. So if you're calmer, then if meditation helps you get calm, it isn't then to escape into calm, but as you come out of meditation, to directly and realistically enter your life, meet your life as it is, but meet it with that calm. As meditation deepens for people and gets stronger, people get more concentrated, one of the very nice qualities is confidence, a certain kind of natural dignity or lack, you know, there's a dropping away of the lack of confidence, because lack of confidence, doubt, is seen as being an activity of the mind. If you feel, inadequate or kind of bad about yourself, it's a curious thing that that's an activity of the mind, that your mind is thinking that way, creating that idea. And as you get calmer and stop adding ideas and thoughts on top of your life, there arises a natural kind of confidence that is nice to have. And if you enter into your world with that confidence, you have a very different attitude towards the struggles of your life. If you have more clarity, if you sit and meditate, and you see more clearly what's going on in your mind and your heart, to see what forces operate, your beliefs, your feelings, your attitudes, your common patterns, and you see it more clearly, then chances are you're going to be less caught by it or less driven by it or run by it. So you come out of meditation and you come with that understanding and you step back into your life, hopefully carrying that understanding with you, so that in your life you're less caught by what's going on. And then if you're able to cultivate a little bit more compassion, kindness in meditation, the idea is to bring that back into your life and step back into the life struggles, the situation you have, and meet it with a little more kind heart. It makes a big difference. So meditation is supposed to create a nice context for us to step back and to see our lives in a new way. And one of these ways is that as we get calm and settled and all these other things, we tend not to bring so much of our usual baggage with us when we step into the world of our challenges. And so a lot of the baggages that maybe can drop away temporarily when we meditate is there's baggages or you know, we have all these interpretations and assigning a meaning to the struggles of our life. We have fantasies or projections into the future. This means that this is going to happen in the future, and we create whole universes of the future. Or we attribute a self to it. We build up a self-identity, a self-definition around it. This is happening to me, therefore I'm a bad person, I'm a good person, I'm a desirable person, an undesirable person. There's all these kinds of ideas of self that we add to it. And one of the nice things about meditation is to have these things drop away and not have all the extra baggage, the extra interpretations, the extra ideas on top of our suffering or struggles of our life. And so the image in Buddhism is to step back into the fire, step back into our life as it is. So part of, you know, is to step back into our life, the struggles of our life, the difficulties, the challenges, in a sense, kind of step right into the middle of it when you're ready, not to avoid it. And this is part of the realism of Buddhism. We're not trying to escape or deny the sufferings of our life, the struggles, the tensions, but we're trying to, in a sense, step right into the middle of it in a way that's useful for you and for everyone else. And if you bring less baggage with you, less projections and interpretations and all kinds of things, and are very simple with it, you'll probably be much more effective in addressing it. So meditation can help us suffer in simpler ways. Isn't that nice? It's certainly better than complicated ways. And so we can simplify, and we don't realize how much extra baggage and things we put on top of it. So then we step back in, which is kind of the purpose of what's called the First Noble Truth, is to help us to see, yes, there is suffering, there's stress, there's tension, there's sorrow, there's grief, there's, you know, all kinds of things that we can call suffering. Suffering is just a kind of a word for the psychological challenges that we feel. And then we look at the cause or the origin or what kind of the genesis of that. And this is where it's interesting to consider desire. Desire, you know, human beings, we're called human beings, but I think it's better to call us human desirelings rather than human beings, because few people actually just be. You know, we're human doingers. You know, we're always mostly doing, but a lot of the doing we do is driven by desire. We want things. And there's nothing in and itself wrong with wanting, but necessarily, but desiring is what human beings do. But so you can have simple desires. I could have the desire sitting here, I'd like to go to the beach. It's a nice thing. But I actually have no opportunity today to go to the beach. I have the desire, but you know, it has no charge to it, there's no power or compulsion around the desire, just a nice desire, and it floats by and I leave it alone. But what happens to desire sometimes is it comes along with more than just the simple desire. Sometimes it comes along with a force, a power. We could call it a compulsion. Or sometimes in the modern world we talk about being driven, certain drivenness to it, certain compulsivity. There's certain kind of momentum of the desire where if that desire is impeded, we're frustrated, we have suffering. And one of the ways of defining suffering is that it's what happens to us when forceful or compulsive desires are inhibited, or frustrated, or impeded. So if I want to go to the beach, and no, I don't care if I go to the beach or not, I don't want to, but you know, and if I can't go to the beach, it's not a problem for me. But if I'm thinking about the beach, and like I have to get to the beach, and the beach is a solution to my problems, or that's where I'm going to have some real pleasure, and I really want to have a nice break, and I can't stop thinking about the beach, and I go home to my family and say, let's go to the beach, and they say, not today. Then, the momentum is still there, and that momentum, leads to kind of friction or tension or problems. And sometimes that the power, the compulsivity together with the desire is really weak, and sometimes it's phenomenally powerful. I think it's probably fair that in English we call powerful compulsive desire addiction, because you can't put it down, you're driven by it, you have no choice, you kind of have to do this, have to have it again. The Buddha used the word thirst for this. That desire that comes along with some extra kind of oomph, he described as thirst. And maybe thirst in English, usually if you're really thirsty, there's kind of a compulsive, it's good to drink if you're thirsty. And so one of the sources of our psychological suffering is not our desire, but rather the desire that comes along with compulsion. And so an important thing to do in practice is to start appreciating not only the desires that are behind our suffering, but also to get a feel, a psychological, kind of visceral physical feel for not just the desire, but what comes along with the desire. Sometimes we're blinded by what we want, the thing we want, or things we don't want, because that, the negative desire is part of this as well. And we're kind of addressing the content of the desire. Is it reasonable? Is it not reasonable? But also in practice, what we do is we step back and we look at something different than people usually not so familiar are looking at, and that is the energy, the force that the desire comes along with. And that also kind of opens up the door for us to start seeing there's more going on than the simple desire. So if I want to go to the beach, the desire is to go to the beach, but the compulsion to go to the beach, that has a different genesis, different source. It might be that I think that going to the beach is going to, that I think the purpose of a Sunday is to have pleasure. And the ideal pleasure is to go to the beach. And so it's really kind of this philosophy of pleasure that's driving me to go to the beach. Or it could be that I think that if I can come back with a tan, that a lot of more people will like me. And, I'm kind of pale, I need to get to the beach and get a tan. And so there's a whole other kind of agenda going on that's much more subtle, perhaps. But if you stop and look, feel your way into the compulsion, the energy, the drivenness, the incessant thinking that goes along with wanting that desire, sometimes then we can begin noticing this background beliefs, wishes that are going on that are fueling the desire, that making it more of a compulsion. So the simple thing to say is that if you can drop the compulsivity, then you won't suffer. And some people say if you drop the attachment, you drop the clinging, drop the craving, drop the desire, then you won't suffer. And that's kind of what the third noble truth is about, that if you that it's possible to bring the suffering, to bring the craving, the compulsion to an end. It's possible to settle. But it's very easy to hear this and think that it kind of got a feeling of deprivation. You're supposed to let go of your desires, and then you're left with nothing, And you don't have, you know, you had nothing to begin with. That's why you wanted the desires. You know, and now you're telling let go of desires, and now you feel like nothing again. And it just seems like Buddhism is just a party pooper, right? Just, you know, what are you supposed to do with these desires? But this is where we come to what's called the fourth noble truth, where it's usually explained by what's called the Eightfold Path. And one of the very important aspects of this Eightfold Path, this is eight practices that can be done. And these are, you know, starting to do the kind of Buddhist practices of practicing kindness and compassion, practicing wise speech, practicing ethical conduct, practicing mindfulness, meditation, practicing concentration, the different practices we do. And one of the functions of these practices is to provide us with a feeling of fulfillment. It provides us a feeling of well-being, of feeling alive and present in a way that feels there's a lot of joy and happiness and feeling complete in itself. And the stronger, the more we walk this Eightfold Path and these mature within us, the greater is our sense of fulfillment. I don't know if fulfillment is the best choice of words, but fulfillment or fullness or feeling complete, feeling settled, feeling content and happy in this world of ours. And one of the solutions to, one of the approach to letting go of desire is not to end up with nothing, but it's easy to let go of desires if you're already fulfilled, isn't it? So rather than feeling that you're being deprived by letting go of your desires, of course, when you've eaten your meal and you're full, there's no more hunger. To say, I really want to eat when I'm hungry, and then the Buddha say, well, let go of your desire. You know, that may be hard if you're hungry. But if you've eaten your fill, then it's easier to let go of wanting more food because you're satisfied. So the Eightfold, part of the function of the Eightfold Path is to provide a deep, I want to use the word spiritual because it just has, I want to make sure that we feel it has some kind of deep, heartfelt connection, a deep spiritual sense of satisfaction or fulfillment. And as we become more fulfilled, then it's we shed some of the desires, we shed some of our attachments and cravings we have. We don't need them anymore. We're already so full. And so the teachings of the Four Noble Truths, if one way to look at it is, the problem is I have these compulsive desires and I have to let go of them. And that's kind of leaves people kind of rocky, kind of like shaking a little bit. What am I supposed to do, you know? That's hard to do, and I guess it's true I have compulsive desires, but I hardly see them, I hardly understand them. Where are they? I just know I'm suffering. But if we start walking the path, and it's a slow path, start meditating, start practicing, start living ethically, start living in such a way that we can start be calmer, more confident, have greater clarity, and greater compassion, then something begins shifting and we have a greater sense of satisfaction in being alive. If we're just told to let go of our desires, it's easy to feel kind of bereft, you know, less connected or less satisfied because the satisfaction in life is not there to begin with. So as we do this path and practice and feel a kind of satisfaction in life, then it's easier to let go, let go, let go. And the deepest forms of letting go of desire, of clinging, craving, that Buddhism teaches, generally occur when we have the greatest sense of satisfaction, when we're most peaceful, most at home, most settled here. And generally in our tradition, it's understood to happen through deep meditation. When meditation is a place to feel this deep, deep abiding sense of well-being, deep abiding sense of peace and satisfaction. And so it's not like a deprivation to let go. It's not like frightening to let go at a certain point, deepest letting go. It becomes clear that it's the best thing going. It's like you know, why would you not let go when it's clear, like it just kind of brings that sense of satisfaction to complete fulfillment. Isn't that nice? So we sit, and then there's a willingness to step back into the world of our suffering and to look at it more carefully and to look at it in new ways, not just the old ways of me, myself, and mine, not to identify so strongly with it, and simply to have the confidence to go back and take a look at suffering rather than just being suffering can be a life-changing situation. Here is suffering, as opposed to I am suffering. And then to take a deeper look, to do the investigation. The whole inner ecology of our hearts and minds changes when we investigate, when we're curious, we start looking, what's going on here? What's really happening here? Because if we don't have the curiosity or the interest to look, it's all too easy with our suffering to be carried along by the force of compulsion, the force of identification, the force of attachment, the weight of the suffering. But we say, what? You know, we kind of step back and have a question mark. What is this? Let's look. Even if it's just for a fraction of a moment, to step back and say, ah, this is what's happening. This is what's happening. Begins changing the inner ecology of what's happening, of where we are. So these four statements, which are make up the Four Noble Truths, are from ancient times, are reference points or perspectives that Buddhists live with and bring to their lives to explore, to understand, to question, to investigate, to see in new ways. So we feel, we know, we step back and we look at suffering. Buddhists are really good at looking at suffering. Someone some years ago made bumper stickers that they put on the counter here at IMC, and the bumper sticker said, "I stop for suffering." So, you know, stop and look. But not to suffer better. That's not the point. But in the short term, to suffer in more simple ways. To not add so much on top of it. Just try to be as simple as you can with it. And then to begin looking at what's the cause of the suffering? What's the desire or the compulsion or the drivenness, the thirst that seems to be behind it? And it's a long lifetime investigation. There's all kinds of different kinds of suffering. And sometimes it's obvious that it's our own personal compulsion. And sometimes it's not obvious what our role is. Sometimes it's the conditions of the world that seem so oppressive and so difficult that it seems like really the cause is out there. But if you do enough practice and get calm enough and settled enough, then you'll start seeing it sooner, some point, and when you're ready, when you've taken care of the situation maybe about well enough, start seeing your contribution to it. And that's where the mature aspect of this practice comes to fulfillment, when you really start seeing your contribution to the situation that's very difficult, your contribution to your suffering. And it's possible to bring this suffering to an end. This is the really good news of Buddhism. We step into suffering because we know there's an end. And then when we can't just drop our attachment by itself, then we have this Eightfold Path. And you might think of the Eightfold Path of these different elements of it, these different, as ways of cultivating personal deep satisfaction or fulfillment that doesn't require the world to be different, doesn't require other people to be different, because they're practices that begin changing the inner landscape, your heart. And it's the practices that support the heart, your mind, your inner life, to feel a deep satisfaction, a deep fulfillment, no matter how difficult the external world might be. And to be able to have that confidence, self, satisfaction, fulfillment, to address our suffering, again, changes the whole relationship we have to suffering and changes our relationship to desire. When we're satisfied, we don't need to have desire or thirst or compulsion. So the Four Noble Truths, central teachings of Buddhism that we can use in our lives. So we have about some time here. If you want to ask any questions or comments about this. Yes, and so let me wait for the mics to come.
My question relates to individuals who find value in suffering. For example, people who attain world-class accomplishments are very much driven by their desire to achieve, get better, become well-known, become expert, and they seem to be able to embrace from an early age a great deal of sacrifice and suffering to attain that world-class attainment, and they seem to perhaps even enjoy their suffering or find it very useful. So is that an exception to all of this?
I think you need to look more deeply at what's going on in their minds and hearts. We're complicated beings, right? There's many multiple drives going on at the same time. And I've known people who have been driven for success in a variety of different settings, and it was done at a tremendous cost to themselves, to their family, to others around them. And at some point, when they succeeded at what they were trying to do, only then did they realize that it was an empty goal, that it wasn't really fulfilling. As the status, the success, the money, the wealth, just didn't cut it in the end. And I've known people who deeply regretted their drive that they had. Even though they were conventionally successful, they were deeply regretted what they had done in the past. Some people get a lot of pleasure from status, right, or from wealth, or having power over other people. And so they're quite driven. They suffer because they're trying to get the pleasure of the status, the wealth, or whatever. So I thought maybe you're thinking about different people.
I'll think about that.
Okay.
Just a follow-up question on that question.
Yeah.
When you take a figure like Gandhi, who, if you read his autobiography, was quite driven in many ways, how do you think about his motivations and kind of his drive in his life?
Yeah, I don't know the quality or the aspect of what drove him to do what he did, but I would prefer to use to think of someone like Gandhi, who seems to have been a very mature, wise person. That he wasn't driven, he was motivated. And there's nothing, having desire and having a very strong motivation, very strong to participate in it and get behind it in a very strong way, there doesn't have to be any suffering, there doesn't have to be any compulsion with it. And I know that Gandhi taught from the one of the primary Bibles for him was the Bhagavad Gita, which he interpreted in as an allegory. And one of the things there, one of the important teachings there, is to act or have desire with no expectation for the outcome. So sometimes what part of the compulsion that's behind our desires is we're attached to the outcome of what we want. So I can well imagine that the Gandhi was not driven. But he had because he was such a free man, he was able to pour a tremendous amount of his energy behind his motivation, but he wasn't tied to the outcome. So Ellen's been trying, so we can move the mic over there.
This is a very timely discussion. I had a really serious conversation yesterday with a woman I've known for over 50 years. She is a very kind human being. And in my opinion, she is compelled to help other people. I have seen her do this over and over and over again at great cost to her physical and mental well-being. And yesterday, as we were talking, she was grown up in the Christian church. And she is, in some ways, incredibly devout, although not a churchgoer. And she said to, there was a couple of us talking, she said, I was taught that suffering is a virtue. I didn't know what to say. So I'm wondering what I might say to her. I mean, I know what I have said, but what I might say to somebody who believes that very strongly.
Yeah, I don't know. But this is I don't know what to say, but this is an example where suffering is usually not simple. There's beliefs that come along with it, and complicated beliefs. And there can be deep-seated religious beliefs that go along with it. And I don't know about her, but one of the virtues, one of the benefits of suffering well is that then there's a reward for you in the afterlife. And so then for some people, then it's connected to fear. There can be deep fear and anxiety that gets satisfied or gets met with the belief system that where suffering, the need, the importance of suffering or the importance of helping other people is addressing this deep underlying fear of what's going to happen after you die. And so there's all this other stuff going on. So, I mean, I don't know about your friend, but and I don't know what you can say to your friend. It would be ideal if she could sit really quietly and start seeing and understanding the nature of how the mind thinks and believes in things. So tease apart all this for herself.
So in this sounds terrible. In some ways, it's like she's collecting suffering badges to get a better place in heaven. I mean, is that?
I don't know her, but yeah. I know there are people who do that.
Yeah.
And so, and sometimes when it's a religious beliefs that people have, I mean, I think it's important to respect them. But I think religious beliefs also sometimes are. People grew up with them from a very early age, it seems like it's almost like the very structure of their thinking requires those beliefs. And so it's not so easy just to kind of talk someone out of it because it's just how reality is seen. Yes?
I haven't been here in a very long time, so I'm actually quite afraid to say what I'm going to say. And it's very, very timely for me, too, to come today. I guess what I'm hearing is that there have been a number of concerns about how other people are leading their lives. And my concern, and I don't know if the word concern is correct, is what am I doing?
Beautiful. I'm happy to hear this.
Because I can't judge or sort out for somebody else. It's their path. And I'm not articulating this very well, but I just think that the issue is to work on oneself, if that's the correct term, and hope for the best for others.
I'm delighted that you said this. I should have said that earlier. And your observation that the discussion was about other people was very apt to what happened here this morning. And I think that we want to be careful not to be blinded by always concerned about other people, because the real path is here in us. And then as we get transformed, then we can meet the world in a new way. And that's the real path. So the fact that you bring this up, I'm delighted, and so thank you. So I hope also if you felt anxious about saying it, now you can relax. Yes.
In response to her comments.
Yeah.
Oh, hello.
Yeah.
In response to her comments.
Yeah, you have to hold it.
Hello?
Yeah.
Is that better?
Yeah.
Okay. There seems to be a, I'm also relatively new here, so there seems to be a certain, hello? Like this? Okay. There is a certain language to this practice, and the word suffering has its own meaning, and I wonder if it's possible that this woman's friend has a different interpretation of that word and is using it differently.
That's a great question, yes. And that's one of the problems, I think, with this kind of discussion of the Four Noble Truths and using the word suffering over and over and over again. These Buddhists, that's all they talk about. it's an abstract word. It's, you know, it's a secondary word. It doesn't really point to something immediate, you know, that grief would be more immediate. Grief is a kind of suffering, but it's a kind of secondary category word. So yeah, I think it's a great point to start asking more deeply what people mean by it, and it's possible that two people are using the same word or same idea, and they have different ideas of what they're talking about.
And along with that, my next question is, what would you think of the word sacrifice as an alternate word for suffering? And I'm wondering if that might be something that this woman is thinking of, that sacrifice is something that is valuable and a virtue. And what would Buddhism think of that word?
That could well be. It could be that you know, sacrifice means to make sacred. So it's possible that what you're saying makes me think that rather than bring Buddhism to this lady, maybe help her understand her own religion deeper, mm-hmm. and perhaps there are Christian or Catholic ways of understanding what she's doing that would help her go deeper and deeper into her own tradition, mm-hmm. and she could suffer better. But she'd be really happy because suffering gets transformed into something else.
My suffering is grief of somebody that died, and I've been trying during meditation to see what the compulsion is behind it, and I'm not sure I really want her to be back alive. I mean, or I guess I do, but I don't feel a compulsion. I feel more a vacuum,
yeah.
A hole.
Yeah. So grief is something to be very careful with. and this is where the whole idea, I think, the Four Noble Truths idea of suffering is should be understood. What is being talked about in the First Noble Truth, the suffering that's being talked about, is the suffering that arises from some kind of attachment. If there's pain, which doesn't arise out of attachment, then it's just pain. So grief can have both elements in it. Grief can have aspects of just pain. I think it's ordinary to feel grief when someone close to us have died. And it can just be ordinary pain. But then there can also be connected to that or confused with that or entangled with that are a lot of attachments that people have. And so it could be resistance. It could be identification with it. It could be assigning meaning to it, interpreting it in ways that makes it much more oppressive, much more heavy. And the stories we have connected to it. So one of the aspects of this practice here is to be very, very respectful of grief, but use the practice to help us get out of the way of it. Just to let it be simple grief. Just let it be there without the added stories, the added meaning, the added identifications, the shoulds, the shouldn'ts. I mean, a very simple way that people suffer more because of grief is their friends will come after a few months, will say, you should be over it by now. And then they feel, oh, gee, you know, like, you know, I've been meditating for years. I should be just, you know, whistling happily down the street. You know, what's wrong with me? But, you know, the pain of grief, the grief has its own time, right? So part of the gift of this practice is to help us be very simple with it. And when we're simple with it and kind of trust the inner life, then it unfolds the way kind of it's meant to unfold. But if we're complicated with it or attached to it or relate to it, you know, then we can just perpetuate it and make it much more difficult. Does that address your concern?
Yes, thank you.
So one more, Dante. If you maybe move there. Yeah, okay.
Thank you. let's see. I'm not sure if this sounds redundant. I don't think it is. Christianity keeps coming up for me with this, and just the fact that we're, you know, here in the West, and it's like our society, you know, it's kind of suffering seems to be woven kind of into the fabric of our society, just through the teachings of Jesus dying on the cross, suffering. And so I think, you know, I grew up Catholic, and as, you know, when I started pursuing the Buddhist teachings, I've tried to, you know, really kind of flip my perspective. And so earlier when you mentioned hunger and, you know, it's this desire, actual hunger, like when you're actually hungry for food, I'm thinking, actually when I get hungry, sometimes if I'm at work or something, I want to take a break and eat, I will pay attention to that. And then I think, well, I don't want to be desiring this food right now. So then my next thought after that is, well, what if I just tough it out and just wait, and maybe I'm not actually hungry, you know? And then, you know, going back to it being ingrained in us through our society to suffer on the cross like Jesus did, I think about when the Buddha... if I'm not mistaken, he was kind of starving himself at one point as well. And then he gave that up and found it wasn't useful. But to know the difference between those two things, like, can you speak to that?
Well, we're kind of running out of time, but that's a big question. But... I don't know much about Christianity. So in terms of that part of your question, I didn't grow up Christian, and so I grew up in a Christian society, but I didn't really learn much about it. I have met Christians who have inspired me, a deep spirituality, a deep abiding sense of peace and happiness that seems to have come out of their engagement with Christianity. So I think there's, as you probably know, there's a wide range of fairly sophisticated, maybe very wise interpretations of the suffering of Christ and what suffering is, and there are Christians who've been, you know, have come to some kind of other side of suffering that's been very important, very meaningful for them. So we don't want to kind of put Christianity into one little box, you know, just all about suffering. But how all that works and what Christians do, and it's not something I feel qualified to talk about. But we should stop. If it seems like a lot of interest in this topic, you can now talk to each other about it. So we have this tea now. So please stay, and if you're new, introduce yourself to people. People here are friendly, and you can just walk up to people and say hello. And if you see someone who seems to be new, and you've been around for a while, say hello to them. If you've been around for a while, see if you can say hello to one new person today. And if you'd like, stay for the tea, and I guess it's being set up out there. And thank you for this morning.